Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear from a journalist and author who spent much of the past decade covering the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Rajiv Chandrasekaran is a senior correspondent and associate editor of the Washington Post who reported on the start of the war in Afghanistan and events in Pakistan, and more recently followed the events of the surge from 2009 through last year. And he was examining the impact of President Obama's decision to double U.S. troop levels during that time. His book on that decision and what resulted has just been published, Little America, The War Within the War in Afghanistan. It's published by Knopf. Chandrasekaran is also the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, an account of the disastrous Coalitional Provisional Authority's attempts to rebuild Iraq immediately after the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime. He won the Overseas Press Club Book Award and provided a first-hand view of life inside the Baghdad Green Zone. Chandrasekaran was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, and I spoke with him while he was in town. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here with you today.
We certainly have weakened the Taliban by most objective measures, but was the cost in men and material worth it?
Well, you're getting right at the most fundamental question about our strategy there, President Obama's decision to surge more troops, to embrace a counterinsurgency strategy that called for a real robust effort at providing security and trying to rebuild the government and trying to reconstruct the Afghan economy and society. And as we step back here now, 3 years into this effort, as the surge is becoming a drawdown, after having spent since the beginning of this conflict, probably about $500 billion. After 2,000 plus brave American men and women have given their lives over there, and thousands more have been badly wounded, many of whom have lost limbs. And as we're at a point where Osama bin Laden has been killed, not in Afghanistan, but in neighboring Pakistan, that much of the senior ranks of al-Qaeda have been decimated through CIA-led drone strikes over the past couple of years. This is the fundamental question. Was it worth it? It's a complicated question to answer. You know, the surge has accomplished things on the ground. It's undeniable. Anytime we send our military into a place, they will improve security in the discrete areas where they are stationed. When we send in our diplomats and aid workers, things will improve. And that's what's happened in various pockets of southern and eastern Afghanistan.
I think the question is, though, you say, but next door.
But next door in Pakistan, the Taliban still enjoy sanctuaries. In Kabul, the Afghan capital, the Afghan government is still incompetent and corrupt. The Afghan army is still pretty raggedy. And so the question then becomes, in these places where we have improved security at the cost of American lives and limbs, will the Afghans be able to take the baton from us and maintain that security? And will the gains we've made against the Taliban be sustainable? Or as we draw down, will the insurgency once again reorganize? As we see from near daily attacks there, will they be able to control the country? Look, I don't believe that as our troops come home and all of our conventional combat forces are supposed to be out by the end of 2014, we'll probably keep a small presence of special forces there to conduct missions into the future and some military trainers there. As our men and women come in uniform come out, I don't think the Taliban are going to be able to sweep in to Kabul and other major cities with the same ease as they did in the 1990s. But I think they will expand control of remote villages and valleys. And the Afghan army and the Afghan government, I think, will be able to hold on to some key areas. It's going to be messy. It's going to be chaotic. It's going to be violent. It's going to defy traditional notions of victory. But it's also not going to seem like helicopters lifting off from the roof of the embassy. So could we have gotten to this messy but perhaps good enough for American national security outcome without the troop surge, without the additional lives and limbs and billions of dollars spent? I think so. And this is a lot of what I write about in Little America. In telling the story of the surge, I think once you're through the book, the reader comes away with that inevitable conclusion.
Let's talk about American national security concerns. The reason we went to Afghanistan, it was a measure of revenge for 9/11, but it was also to eliminate al-Qaeda sanctuaries within Afghanistan. Now, certainly they seem to have them in the northern frontier of Pakistan today. But have we, at least through this long conflict, if the Taliban does control the remote valleys in Afghanistan, are they going to divorce themselves from al-Qaeda?
Look, that's a very good question. I think that it's too early to tell. There are certainly signs that if the Taliban were to take control of broader parts of the country, they may not act as they did in the late 1990s when they gave sanctuary to al-Qaeda. We should also recognize that while al-Qaeda, what's left of it, may do crazy things, they are fundamentally rational actors. And if the cost of doing business for them is greater in Afghanistan than Pakistan, they're not going to relocate there. They have it pretty good in Pakistan now. And setting up training camps and other things in Afghanistan, it just is going to be very difficult, particularly if we keep a small number of special forces, special operations troops, Navy SEALs, Delta Force guys on the ground there, and we can go and schwack any of those training camps or safe houses that our intelligence might uncover. That's probably good enough to keep al-Qaeda out and allow us to focus on the parts of the globe where al-Qaeda really remains potent. Parts of Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. It's other places in the globe that actually present a greater threat to American national security than the remote valleys of Afghanistan today.
And it sounds like, you know, what influence do we have with Pakistan these days? It seems like our relationship is pretty frayed.
Well, and the decision to surge, to send more troops, helped contribute to a fraying of that relationship. Pakistan, the fundamental truth is, the Pakistani government, the Pakistani military, doesn't really want stability in Afghanistan because they know that a stable Afghanistan would actually be closer to India than Pakistan. The Afghans would want a better relationship with India for a variety of reasons.
What are some of those reasons? Because I would think, you know, from just a long distance, it looks like they have more in common with the Pakistanis.
Here's a fascinating fact. In September 1947, when the new nation of Pakistan applied for membership in the United Nations, what was the one country to vote no?
Afghanistan?
Yes. It wasn't India. It was Afghanistan. Why? Because of historical conflicts between the Pashtuns and non-Pashtuns, but also belief among many Afghans that historically Afghanistan actually encompassed much of what is Pakistan, divided, you know, decades upon decades ago by the British. But there are other reasons that are more profound today. As a landlocked country, Afghanistan has to depend on commerce coming through Pakistan, and it feels that Pakistani traders charge unfairly high prices, that they restrict the export of Afghan produce coming out of the country. And so they feel like they're in a vice put there by Pakistan. The Indians helped support northern Afghans in their civil war with the Taliban a decade ago. Even for those ethnic Pashtuns in the south and the east, India is always seen as the land of great economic and educational opportunity. Where did President Hamid Karzai go to school? In India. Mm. And the Pakistanis know this. And the Pakistanis worry that if they leave Afghanistan alone and Afghanistan develops a closer relationship with India, it essentially has enemies on both fronts. And they can't afford to have an Indian-allied Afghanistan on their rear flank. So they support the Taliban, they stir the pot in Afghanistan so they can maintain influence.
Just keep
there.
It weak and compliant.
Yes. And our belief, as Washington surged more troops there, that Pakistan would somehow be a cooperative actor and crack down on these Taliban sanctuaries was fundamentally misplaced.
We would assume that a country would want a stable neighbor on its borders.
Yes, but in this case, No. It actually, instability benefits them.
Interesting. My guest today is Rajiv Chandrasekharan, a senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post. His latest book is titled Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. And he goes, you traveled throughout Afghanistan for all throughout the surge and, you know, in drainage canal ditches, on bases, in Washington, as well as in Kabul. You know, we think of this place as a place of intrigue, and then the intrigues probably had intrigues themselves. But I want to talk about Little America. This was not our first rodeo in Afghanistan. It wasn't even our second rodeo if you count the insurgency against the Soviet Afghanistan. You detail an effort right after World War II in which we tried to do a bit of nation building in Afghanistan.
Yeah, most people think that our experience there, our involvement, has only been since September 11th, 2001. Actually, it starts out in the late 1940s. The story begins in the late 30s as Jewish fur traders forced to flee Europe as the Nazis are advancing, resettle in the United States, need a new source for fur pelts to make coats and hats. And they turn to Afghanistan for the fur of the newborn Persian fat-tailed sheep. And in the late 30s and early 40s, Afghanistan was exporting between 1 million and 2 million wool pelts a year to the United States. The sale of each one put a few more dollars in the Afghan king's treasury. And so remarkably, at the end of the Second World War, Afghanistan was sitting on this huge windfall, $150 million in gold and silver reserves. And so what the king did in Afghanistan was he hired the American firm that had built the Hoover Dam and the San Francisco Bay Bridge and brought them to Afghanistan and said, look, I want to transform the barren desert along the Helmand River in the southern part of my country into this verdant agricultural oasis. I want to create a breadbasket for my country to feed my people. And so these American engineers dug a network of irrigation canals, built dams. They tried to recreate what we were building in the Central Valley of California, a real swath of very productive farmland. Well, that project didn't really work out so well. It turns out that the soil in southern Afghanistan is very salty. And the way the Afghans would water their fields, which was to flood them, put more salts into the soil. And so the hoped-for breadbasket never really materialized. Along the way, these Americans thought that perhaps they could do something else too, that they could help to modernize this very kind of primitive part of Afghanistan. And so they set up for themselves this town, 8 square blocks with suburban-style homes, with manicured green front lawns. They built the country's first and only co-ed school. They built a swimming pool where boys and girls could swim together. They set up a clubhouse with nightly card games and weekly square dances and where you could get a gin and tonic at the bar. And the Americans thought that the Afghans might seek to emulate this for themselves instead of living in mud huts and living very sort of traditional conservative lives out there.
We were sort of creating this post-World War II sort of modern American enclave, and you'll want this too.
As we were building, you know, suburban communities in the United States, the Levitt towns, we thought, okay, the Afghans might want something like that. And the Afghans looked at it and said, no, it's fine for you Americans, but we don't want that for ourselves.
In fact, they rioted over the fact there were co-ed schools.
They did. very, very nasty riots there. And in fact, they probably would have killed all of the Americans in that area had the Afghan army not sort of stepped in to protect them. But the Afghans did look at that place and come up with a name for it. They called it Little America. And that's where I get the title of my book, because it is in those very same canals today that American Marines are fighting against the Taliban in, fighting and dying in. And it's the same geography that we Americans were in 60 years ago that the troop surge unfolded in. And this is a remarkable connection. And many of the same mistakes we made then with regard to the development effort are mistakes we are repeating again today. I mean,
we couldn't find crops that would grow in that valley because of the salinity issues. This time around, we actually found a crop that would grow that would be a very potent export, and that crop was cotton.
Yes.
And given all that evidence, it seems like a no-brainer. And yet the USAID basically said, oh, no, we can't grow cotton.
This is an absolutely remarkable story. And I should note that what is growing there is opium-producing poppies. You know, in Helmand province, where I spent a lot of time, just one province in Afghanistan, where we had dug these canals, back in 2006, it was producing more opium, this one province, than the entire world's heroin junkies could consume in a single year. I mean, just enormous amounts of drugs coming out from there, helping to fund the insurgency, helping to fuel corruption. Before the Soviet invasion, the one crop that really did grow there, that the Afghans liked to grow, was cotton. As you note, it had many virtues. It was a perfect climate for it. It involved a lot of manual labor, so it kept people busy. You didn't have to take it to market right away. And if you had, you know, bumpy roads, it didn't matter. You weren't going to bang up all of your fruits. It was perfect. And the Afghans would sew things like carpets out of it. You know, Afghans sew carpets. And so after 9/11, as the first teams of American Reconstruction workers came into the country. The Afghans told them, help us grow cotton again. We don't want to grow poppy. We recognize that it's illegal. It's against Islam. Let us do what we used to do. And the Americans, after a while, well, they sort of consulted on this, but they told the Afghans, no, sorry, we can't help you. The Afghans said, why? Well, first off, they said, well, you know, you guys don't have a comparative advantage on world markets. You know, Uzbekistan grows cotton more efficiently. Well, perhaps that's the case. But the Afghans weren't going to sell this on the open market. They just wanted to grow cotton so they could sew their own clothes and stuff.
This was the USAID thing that, you know, like Arrow would come and build a factory and make shirts and things like that there? Or what exactly?
Well, I mean, they were thinking of sort of, you know, modern global trade. And each country should only do what is in their great advantage. And if they can't do it super efficiently, don't do it. Well, nothing's efficient in Afghanistan, and this is all about employing people.
I would imagine things are not that efficient in Uzbekistan either.
But then USAID comes up with another reason. They point to a law that was passed in 1986 by then-Senator Dale Bumpers of Arkansas, designed to protect King Cotton in the United States, that prevents the use of U.S. taxpayer money to help another country's cotton industry. Now, of course, USAID could have asked the White House for a waiver on this because of the national security importance of stabilizing Afghanistan. But they chose not to. They said, oh, there's this law. We're not going to help you. And we just squandered an incredibly valuable opportunity to wean thousands of farmers away from growing a drug crop and getting them to grow something that they wanted to grow that would be productive, that would be profitable, and that would actually help their economy develop.
I made a list of about, I could have gone on for a long time, but six missed opportunities. That was one of just USAID not understanding the culture and just misguided in their development efforts. But number one was we started too late. I mean, the surge happened at 2009 after we'd been there for 8 years and fighting this low-level conflict. Afghan people have never welcomed foreign presence. And 2002, as I have read it, they are so war-weary after the Taliban and civil war.
They hated the Taliban so much at that point.
And that, too, that they were willing to give us a chance.
Yes, yes.
And we didn't do anything we didn't really get involved in doing counterinsurgency and real development until 8 years.
You know why? One reason. Iraq. Yeah. We took our eye off the ball. You know, we had the Taliban on the run with a small number of special forces troops, some of them on horseback, CIA operatives. Light footprint, the Taliban melted. We had an opportunity there to build an Afghan government, to build some Afghan security forces, to rebuild that country without a whole lot of effort. But it would require attention. It would require some money. It would require some people. Instead of finishing that job, we went off and invaded Iraq, and we squandered the great opportunity to do that. And so by the time Obama took office in 2009, taking office after a campaign in which he promised to fix Afghanistan, calling Afghanistan the good war, by then Afghanistan was simply too far gone. The problem was so dire that it really would resist any quick fix, any infusion of tens of thousands more troops. And by that point, our presence there had become toxic. The Afghans were willing to give us a chance. But when we finally got our act together and said, all right, we will send more troops, we will commit billions more dollars for reconstruction, by then, most of them had just given up on us.
Hmm. The interesting thing from your book is that, you know, I thought of the surge as being pretty much the counterinsurgency doctrines that were at the heart of the surge pretty well accepted. But actually, you describe in the book that the Marines did it. A lot of Army units really resisted these counterinsurgency tactics, and that backfired as well.
You know, it was a real mixed bag. And what was remarkable to me was how we essentially had different wars being fought in different parts of the country by different commanders. There was not a real cohesive vision here. If a commander wanted to go off and do his own thing, in many cases, there wasn't a whole lot of accountability. This is in part because Afghanistan is a large, geographically diverse country. And so you had these commanders out in areas where there really wasn't a whole lot of oversight on what a certain infantry brigade was doing. But, you know, mentioning the Marines and the Army, you know, another remarkable thing I discovered, and I spell it out in the book, is you would think that when we sent in additional troops in 2009, the first waves of those forces would go to the most important areas. And back in 2009, the most important place in the country to go to was Kandahar. It was the country's second largest city, the biggest city in southern Afghanistan, the real spiritual heartland for the ethnic Pashtuns. And for the Taliban, it was the strategic prize. They were fighting to take over that city because if they could seize it like they did in the 1990s, they'd have a springboard to take over much of the rest of the country. So you'd think, right, that we would send the bulk of our troops to the areas in and around Kandahar to defend this place from the Taliban. Instead, we sent the majority of the first wave of new troops out to neighboring Helmand province, where those engineers were six decades ago, but in places where there really weren't a whole lot of people, in a part of the country where there was about 1% of the country's population. Why? Because of tribal rivalries, not in Afghanistan, but in the Pentagon. The U.S. Marine Corps, which sent that first wave of new forces in, didn't want to essentially work side by side with the U.S. and Canadian armies, which were in the area around Kandahar. They wanted to bring their own helicopters, their own logistics units, and to do so, they needed essentially their own corner of the sandbox. So senior generals at the Pentagon allowed the Marines to go to a place that really wasn't the most strategically important part of the country. And as I write, we squandered the first year of the troop surge by ignoring Kandahar.
That seems like a very old lesson. The Pentagon just seems to have to relearn all the time, these inter-service rivalries. I would think that would be fixed by now, but it's not.
It's not. And I just heard the other day that, you know, in the acquisition of new military radios, again, the Army and the Marines are getting systems that won't talk to each other. It is amazing this many years into it that we continue to have these fiefdoms in the Pentagon.
Another thing that you write about in the book that shows up very clearly is the use of one-year deployments. And even in those one-year deployments, you know, moving back and forth on leave, this didn't really allow us to really understand the culture. And with very few exceptions, a lot of people just punched the button and stayed holed up in Bagram Air Base, or just like they did in the Green Zone in Iraq, waited their time out and left.
As one diplomat told me in Kabul in 2010, it felt like the ninth version of the first year of the war. You'd have a whole new crop of people come in for a 12-month tour. It would take them several months to sort of understand things. And then before long, they'd be thinking about leaving. They'd go, a new group would come in. They would have to try to learn the ropes, build relationships with Afghans who thought they had developed a relationship with the previous guy, but now that person's gone. No continuity, no sharing of information. And we'd send military units from one part of the country to another, so it wasn't like units that went back for a second tour were going back to the same places where they could go and say, ah, remember me from a year ago? I'm back. None of that. The Afghans couldn't understand this, and many American officers and diplomats couldn't understand why we were doing it this way. It was fundamentally counterproductive to what we were trying to accomplish.
Of course, the relationships that did last was between local leaders and the Afghan national government, which you detail the corruption was just, it literally turned many people back to the Taliban. They said the Taliban were looking good by comparison.
Look, the Afghan people have no great love for the Taliban. They know just how brutal the Talibs were when they ran the country in the 1990s. But in many places, the Afghan government is even worse. They shake people down for bribes. They beat people up. They kidnap young boys for pleasure. It's absolutely detestable the way these government officials and local warlords and others behave. And this is a system that has to be fixed. Problem is, President Karzai doesn't want to fix it, in part because his ministers rely on those thugs to funnel money up to them. So it's a kleptocratic network that's very hard to break. The other reason is Karzai believes that if he goes after some of these guys, he will lose his hold on power because he depends on them. But the very fact of the matter is that for local people, for the ordinary Joes over there, they're turning to the Taliban to essentially protect them from their own government. And for basic things, you know, some guy has a couple of his sheep stolen, or he thinks his neighbor stolen his sheep. If he tries to go to the local judge in many cases, he'll be forced to pay a bribe. It'll take months for his case to be heard. If he goes to a Taliban judge, there's speedy justice. Now, sometimes it's brutal. You know, the other guy will lose his hand. But it's justice in their world. And so the Taliban are providing some of those basic services that these rural people want. I mean, their needs are very, you know, modest, right? What they want out of their government is really some basic order and some basic justice. And the Talibs, in some cases, do that in ways that are better than the Afghan government. And we fail to grasp that for far too long. And in fact, as Washington started to pursue this counterinsurgency strategy, you know, a key part of it was, we're going to provide security in these villages so the Afghan government can come and deliver services to the people. And if it does that, the view in Washington was, people will choose to support the government over the Taliban. What Washington failed to understand was the fact that the Afghan people, in many cases, hate their government more than
the Taliban.
That
was their worst nightmare.
Exactly. And they said in many cases, you know, whoa, wait, you Americans are coming here to give us security? Okay, that's great. But we don't want you to bring our government here. You know, parts of Afghanistan, the South and the East, are like Oklahoma or the American West. People want an arm's length relationship with the capital. They don't want Washington telling them what to do about everything. They want to be free to live their own lives. And we didn't get that. We thought that the system of government there just needed to be expanded. And you know, the system is so bizarre. You know, President Karzai has the ability to hire and fire what they call district police chiefs. That's like saying President Obama can choose the police chief in a county in Oklahoma. I mean, what Oklahoma residents would go for that? But this is the system they have in Afghanistan, and we were trying to support it as opposed to listening to what the people wanted.
What a great irony that as strange, as different as Afghanistan culture seems to ours, that in fact one of the things we didn't get was things just like us.
You know, people criticize the United States for going around the world and imposing democracy. And I think to myself, having spent 2 years in Iraq, 3 years traveling through Afghanistan, you know, if only we brought to them the form of democracy that's made America great, you know, a balance between the center and the periphery, states' rights. And the governments that we've helped to create in Iraq and Afghanistan are so centralized. I mean, the Afghan government centralizes power in a way that's sort of unseen in any other country on the planet, save for North Korea. And if we recognized what has made our republic work, perhaps we'd help the Afghans move to a system that actually allowed for some greater decision-making and autonomy at the local level. And the fact of the matter is that's also a way to address corruption and inefficiency. Why tell the local people, oh, hey, your central government's going to be the ones to open the school over here? If the local people want a school, they should band together, build the school, hire a teacher, collect the local tax revenue to pay for it. That's what we do in our country, and yet we can't seem to bring ourselves to teach those lessons to people around the world.
I'll leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa, senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post, and the author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. It was published this summer by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher.